Support comes from Empower Missouri's Affordable Housing Coalition, working to address the causes of housing insecurity and homelessness through tenant advocacy. Information at empowermissouri.org/housing.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. The race to succeed Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin contains one of the most competitive Democratic primaries of the 2026 election cycle. And U.S. Representative Robin Kelly of Chicago believes that she can stand out in a crowded field. Kelly joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to talk about her campaign platform and why she would be the best successor to Durbin. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, an in-depth examination of Missouri and Illinois politics.
The instant we got to Illinois, we joined the Green Party. This was 2000.
So I've tried to push for those that I think are honest and really care about the future of the city.
You know, this wasn't a path that I thought I would choose in 2012 when I was able to win the closest Republican victory in the nation.
If it's something that will help Southern Illinois, I'll work with him on it. If there's something he's doing wrong, then you got to fight him on it.
I believe very strongly in the Second Amendment. I believe less government is better, and I believe local control is better.
I choose to fight for working families and for union members.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Joining us is St. Louis Public Radio's Metro East reporter,
Will Bauer.
And one of the candidates who is running to succeed U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. She currently is the congresswoman for Illinois' 2nd District. Our guest today is
Robin Kelly.
Thank you so much for joining us today. A lot of our listeners may not be familiar with your work as the 2nd District congressional congresswoman, given that, like, our audience is primarily the Metro East of Illinois. So tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got involved, and why you're running in this contest.
Wow. Well, I've been in Congress 13 years. Prior to that, I was a state representative for 4 years. I was Alexei Janulis's chief of staff for 4 years. And I worked for Tony Preckwinkle as the chief administrative officer for 2 years. Actually came to the Metro East area a lot when I was the chief of staff for Alexei, because we brought a lot of our financial programs to the Metro East area. So I got to know, you know, folks down there. When I was a state rep, Yvetta Young was the state rep. So I came down with her some of the time. So I'm not unfamiliar with the Metro East area. In fact, I was there not too long ago. But I, again, been in Congress 13 years, do a lot of work around healthcare, a lot of work around gun violence prevention, consumer protection, and dibble dabble in technology because my young staff forced me into it.
Most important question we're going to ask you today, Cubs or White Sox, Congresswoman?
Oh boy, you are exposing me. That was the first, when I passed my first bill when I was a state representative, that's what they said. You sound funny. Do you root for the Cubs or the Sox? And I said, I don't root for either one. But of course, downstate is root for the Cardinals. But I must confess, I grew up in New York. I can't tell a lie.
Wait, so Yankees or Mets then?
I actually root for both.
You root
for both?
I know
that's
okay.
Unusual in Illinois territory.
People can't see this. I just ran over to my closet and I am a White Sox fan, even though they are the worst baseball team in history now. I will not stop supporting them. But
my husband died 2 years ago, a staunch White Sox fan. And then my daughter, she roots for the Cubs and the Yankees.
Okay, well, let's get into the nitty-gritty of the race, which this is a pretty intense one to succeed Senator Durbin, right? A lot of the race will probably be decided in the Democratic primary. Were you expecting this race to be so intense, Congresswoman?
Well, you know, I've heard different people might run. Actually, people don't realize there's actually 12 people in the race because they mostly hear about three of us, maybe four of us with Kevin Rand that drives the school bus. So, I knew, you know, this is the first opportunity in a while, you know, so I'm not surprised that people have jumped in the race.
And I wanted to ask you about some of the recent polling that was done by Emerson College, which has you placed in third at 8%. Raja Krishnamoorthy leads the pack at 31%, and Juliana Stratton sits at 10%. But 46% are still undecided. And I just wanted to note, too, that Raja Krishnamoorthy has raised a ton of money. So how, in your position right now, do you kind of break through to get to the top of the pack?
Well, I don't think I need as much money as Raja. First of all, I was a state rep. I was the party chair. I was Alexi's chief of staff. So I've been around the state. I lived in Peoria, mostly on for 20 years. My kids were born there. I worked at Methodist Hospital. So I'm familiar with the state, and my district is urban, suburban, and rural. I have 4,500 farms in my district. So I have a microcosm of Illinois in my district. And most of my farmers don't probably look like me or vote like me, but I have a very good relationship with my farmers. And actually, from Danville to Pontiac, I have definitely done the work so people feel comfortable with me as their congresswoman. I'm working hard, and different polls say different things, and I'm trying to get in front of as many people as possible. I'm going to raise the money, or I am raising the money that I need. I will be going up on TV soon. That will take me through election day.
Well, I want to get into some of the issues. One of the things that when you first ran for Congress, it was right after the mass shooting in Sandy Hook. And I would say that gun control, gun safety, however you want to call it, has been one of your biggest issues in Congress. What would you try to do in the Senate to kind of further that? And then I have a follow-up question based off the horrific events in Minnesota, that But I want to ask you just generally what your plans are in the Senate on that issue.
Yeah, I helped pass the first gun safety measure in 30 years, a bipartisan Safer Communities Act. My thing around gun violence was always the trafficking and store purchasing. In fact, I passed legislation with Don Harmon and Barack Obama around store purchasing. It was my first bill I passed when I was a state representative. Every time I went back to DC, people would say, "What is up with Chicago? They have the toughest gun laws." But if no one else around you has tough gun laws, trafficking and then store purchasing, it makes it, very, very difficult. So definitely we have legislation that passed twice in the House stopping the cycle of violence. That's getting to the root causes and giving resources to people closest to the problem because they're closest to the solution. Effective gun violence prevention organizations. Also, we still don't have universal background checks. We still haven't closed loopholes that you saw that play out at Mother Emanuel Church when the nine church members were killed, that he brought his gun from a brick and mortar store, but when it came back and just, not yes or no, so they sold him the gun, and then a couple days later it came back, don't sell him the gun, but it was too late then. So I would work on those issues and making sure that agencies got the money, effective agencies received the money that they need to receive. There was $158 million allocated for gun violence prevention programs. The president pulled those back, $16 million in Chicago. I'm very proud that I have the Brady Pack's endorsement. I have Senator Murphy's endorsement. He's been my partner, in gun violence prevention, along with, some of the members from the House and some other members in the Senate. So I would definitely carry on the work.
So here's what I want to ask about what happened in Minnesota. There was a man who was an ICU nurse who was killed by federal officials, and he was legally carrying his firearm. And what I've seen in the last 24 to 48 hours is frankly a breathtaking reversal of how people, Republicans and Democrats, have reacted to this. Because Republicans are now saying, well, he shouldn't have had his gun there, and apparently conceal and carry is only allowed when the government says you can. And the Democrats mainly have said, no, he was allowed to carry that gun and he didn't brandish it. So my question is, has people's views on restricting firearms changed from what we've seen over the past year, given that there are, I've seen just anecdotally, a lot of people who are on the left end of the spectrum are now openly talking about buying guns because they're afraid of the federal government right now.
No, I've heard that too, but I've heard that even leading up to this, even before. But I think that even the Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, which I'm the vice chair of, the chair of it, guns are his hobby. So it's not that we're against guns. We just want to make sure if you have a gun, you have it legally and you're not trying to hurt yourself or anybody else. I mean, the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment, and whichever states, that have conceal and carry, I think that's where Dems are coming from. He had his rights to do that, and Republicans have always said that Second Amendment, your rights. And this guy, that's what he was doing. That was his right to do it, and he still, lost his life, even though they took the gun away from him. So that doesn't make any sense at all. He was unarmed. He wasn't a threat. It was that one guy and seven or eight officers.
Before we continue on talking immigration, I did want to ask about one more question about gun violence. And I'm imagining that in order to get maybe some of your legislative proposals passed, you would need to get 60 votes, which requires beating the Senate filibuster. And it seems like both parties tend to talk about getting rid of the filibuster when they aren't in power, or sorry, getting rid of it when they are in power and keeping it when they aren't in power. What do you think? Should the filibuster go away?
It's a tough question. And I would say 99.9, I think we should get rid of it. In the House, we don't have it. And, majority rules. But I also know that it has stopped some things that we wanted to do because it's in place. But also, we've tried to get the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act passed. We've tried to get voting rights passed. We tried to get stopping the cycle of violence passed. And we couldn't, we could pass it in the House, but we couldn't pass it in the Senate because we didn't have enough votes.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask about immigration. And before the events that transpired over the weekend in Minnesota, you had made headlines for introducing articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Why is that necessary in your view?
It's necessary in my view because she is leading a reign of terror across the United States, California, Illinois, Louisiana, North Carolina, Maine, Minnesota, and I know New York is expecting, her to come in, and she has got to be stopped. We cannot use an agency that taxpayers are paying for. We're weaponizing them against people in the United States. We talked about the two people that died in Minnesota, but we had a gentleman die in Illinois, and we've had other people die too, just from, from ICE, but also in the detention facilities, we've had people die. This cannot continue. She's an incompetent leader, and frankly, it seems like she's enjoying herself, and they're putting so much spin on things. And then, a normal police department, if someone shoots somebody, they take their gun. They put them on desk duty or relieve them of their duties for a little while the investigation takes place. That does not appear to be happening. And why are these people wearing masks? Who are these people? Have they been vetted? What has their training been or their orientation? I feel, and I know a number of us feel, that some of these folks are the insurrectionists that had me on my hands and knees January 6, 5 years ago. It is very scary. People are scared to go to work, scared to go to school, scared to shop, are scared to go to the doctor. And these are Americans and undocumented. We've talked a lot about affordability. This is affecting, people's bottom line. Their pay is affecting small businesses. Businesses are closing because, of what's happening, at least closing temporarily. So this is horrific. And when we look back in history, I know people will wonder what the hell was going on in this country. She needs to be stopped.
There has been polling, even at the day of the shooting of Alex Pretty, that says now a majority of respondents want to abolish ICE. Are you one of those people that want to just completely abolish this agency? And if so, what replaces it? Because there is going to be something that probably has to enforce immigration laws, even if it is not this specific agency.
I want to dismantle ICE as a part of immigration reform. We need to look at ICE. We need to look at border patrol. We need to look at USCIS that oversees asylum. We need to look at what's happening with the Dreamers. We need to look at the over 11 million people here, but are paying taxes and contributing to society, but are not going to get anything out of it when they retire. So I think that we need to dismantle it. And this ICE, ridiculous, but it because it's being weaponized. But we do need to dismantle ICE as well as a part of immigration reform and looking at the agency and those particular areas of the agency. I know TSA is a part of it and FEMA, but we need to look at the parts that deal with immigration.
Wanted to ask you about some other issues too. You mentioned affordability just a minute ago. If you're elected to the Senate, how should Congress, the Senate, approach affordability?
Well, I'm running on a platform of people over profits, and it's about time that millionaires, billionaires, and corporations, the well-off and well-connected, pay their fair share of taxes. That's just the bottom line. If they pay their fair share of taxes, then we can invest in housing and affordable housing. In the richest country in the history of the world, we can have health care, for everyone. We can cap childcare, people paying more for childcare than they are paying for rent. We can raise wages. We can invest in economic development so there's economic opportunity for people. I would say that, along with clawing back the big tax breaks that the president gave to, the millionaires, trillionaires, and the corporations, those two things combined would move this country a long way forward.
And I noticed that a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was on cable news, your primary opponent, Juliana Stratton, had said, along the theme of making life more affordable for everyday Americans, that she would propose a $25 minimum wage. Do you think that's reasonable?
I don't think that's realistic. When you have served in Illinois and, veto-proof House, veto-proof Senate, everybody's a Democrat, you could maybe talk about, things like that. But even here, I don't think that's very realistic. I don't think that's something, that we can get past. I think that something closer to $17 an hour that we can get Democrats, but some Republicans to agree with that too. But I'm not gonna, I don't wanna make empty promises or just throw big numbers out like it's realistic because I've been there 13 years. So I've been there 13 years and only in the majority 4 of those years. So I have a good view of what's realistic and what's not.
Before Will gets into some Metro East issues, and before we wrap up, I would be remiss, even though this is now off the headlines because of what happens in Minnesota. The first part of the Martin Luther King holiday weekend was dominated by Donald Trump's belligerent demands that Denmark turn Greenland over to the United States. And who knows, this may resurface by the time you become a U.S. senator. How will you approach this? There is precedent for the United States purchasing land. So this, if we purchased it for a certain amount of money and Denmark said yes, I think it's clearly different than a military invasion. But let's just say you're asked to vote on whether to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to buy Greenland. What would be your mentality toward
Well,
that?
I had an amendment in Congress. It didn't make it. The Republicans didn't let it play out that he couldn't attack Greenland or buy Greenland. We need to pay attention to this country that he's the president of. There are too many people suffering, too many people that, can't afford to buy groceries, more people that don't have jobs. A lot of people lost their jobs since he's been the president. People need health care, the ACA tax premiums. We passed it, got it passed in the House. It still hasn't passed in the Senate. He needs to pay attention to this country and put money into this country, not buy Greenland, not bail out Argentina with $20 billion. Pay attention to the country that you were elected to run.
Wanted to ask you about some local issues down here in the Metro East. First one is the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. So, as part of Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, 21 Missouri zip codes were added into that program this past summer. and that gives the community members who are sick an ability to get compensation for their ailments. And Congresswoman Budzinski had asked for one zip code on the Illinois side of the river in Venice, Madison, and Granite City to be included, but that didn't make it in the final bill. Would that be something that you would be interested in advocating for as if you were to win the Senate race?
Definitely. I'm on energy and commerce now. Healthcare is my biggest portfolio, so I'm always concerned about people's health, and people should not have to suffer because of what a company did. I definitely agree with Nikki and will do everything I can to support her, even be her Senate sponsor.
The other issue I wanted to ask is U.S. Steel, which I imagine you could maybe be familiar with, given that you represent the border with Indiana, where Gary Works, one of the biggest U.S. Steel mills, is located. And they've been in the headlines recently down here, too, for the recent acquisition from the Japanese firm Nippon. And they recently down here got some good news, short-term news, about restarting one of the two blast furnaces. But I wanted to ask you about the role the Trump administration has taken in the deal. And they have what's known as a golden share, which right gives the federal government a board seat and veto authority in U.S. Steel decision making. And anyway, according to the admin, they recently banned Granite City from permanently closing. The U.S. Steel CEO actually disputed that recently. But anyway, they've taken this role, and they've done so with profit sharing deals with the chip maker Nvidia too. So I just wanted to ask broadly, what do you kind of make of the federal government's intervention into private business that we've seen in the past year from the Trump administration?
Well, first of all, I like the idea that I'm a part of the Steel Caucus because where I represent, there were a lot of, industry. And like you said, I'm right on the Indiana border. So I'm going to support what will bring steel workers back to work. I don't like his intervention. And, since he's been president, he's made $1 billion and him looking out for him. That's what it basically comes down to, in a lot of different ways. So I do support the plant reopening and putting people back to work. I think that's, very, very important. And but I don't support his hand in everything, like he's the dictator or the king, like his way or no way, and hopefully we can find more investments so more steel workers can go to work.
Last local issue I wanted to ask you about is Cokie Heights. This is a St. Louis suburb that's just south of East St. Louis, and it has a
Been
really
there.
decrepit, oh, you've been there, amazing. Okay.
Yeah.
Really decrepit and aging sewer infrastructure system that's been plaguing residents for a long, long time. Senator Durbin has been down here pretty recently, in the last couple of years for congressional earmarks. So I'm wondering, as a senator, what would you want to do to fix this long-term problem that's still persisting even after all these years and all the millions of dollars that's been allocated to the city?
Well, as I said, my district is urban, suburban, and rural, and in some parts of my district, I have some very poor communities that have, sewer problems, that have water problems, and we've worked so well in the district I have with the Army Corps of Engineers. I used to call myself, Miss Army Corps because we've done so much in so many of our communities. And then my staff actually has just worked with Ford Heights, a very, very poor community because they had such leakage problems from their old pipelines, and people were paying their water bills, but so much was leaking out because the pipes were old. So I would continue, work with the Army Corps of Engineers, to get the best recommendations of what should be done, and then continue to put resources in because it's a waste of water. You want to make sure also that the water that the pipes of water flowing through is safe. So, and water is very important in a person's life. So I would continue, what Dick Durbin has done, and but under the guise of the Army Corps to see what they recommend since they're, definitely the experts.
Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
Politically
you.
Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And for people who want to know more about your campaign, where can we find you on the internet where you want to be found?
RobinForSenate.com. Join the fight.
Thank you very much. And until then, so long. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.